Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is HTTP Protocol Breakdown Response Headers. Today's presenter is Robert L. Boretti, Jr. Robert has been with the IBM Corporation for 12 years and supporting the IBM HTTP Server and WebSphere HTTP plugin for 7 years, and currently an advisory software engineer with L2 WebSphere Application Server Support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Robert.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for attending today's session. As Joseph had indicated, my name is Robert L. Boretti, Jr., and I've been supporting the IBM HTTP Server and WebSphere HTTP plugin for many years now. And one of the opportunities I've had when supporting this product is I've been able to learn a lot about the HTTP protocol. And during the course of my debugging of customer problems, I've come to the realization that understanding HTTP request and response headers and status codes has been very, very important to know. And as a result of which, I've decided that I'd like to share this opportunity to present to you today what some of the HTTP response headers are that we see in WebSphere application server environments so that you too can understand them, as well as know where to find them in your own environments by looking at logs. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 2 to get started. Okay, well, the main focus of today's presentation will be to help you to understand the common HTTP response headers, which are most often seen in WebSphere application server environments when requesting dynamic and static HTTP content. So whether you're requesting dynamic content from WebSphere, static content from WebSphere, or even static content from your web server. For additional information, you may consider reviewing RFC 2616 Section 14, which contains detailed descriptions of all HTTP headers, including the response headers discussed in today's presentation. Today, I will specifically focus on providing you a description of common response header fields. Next, I will provide you examples of actual recorded HTTP response headers to help you to put things into context when it comes to observing these headers in your own WebSphere application server environment. Lastly, I will identify and provide examples of specific log outputs where these headers are recorded so you can find them in your WebSphere application server environments later on. These logs include TCPIP packet traces, web server access logs, the WebSphere HTTP plugin log, along with the WebSphere application service trace.log. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 3 to actually get started with discussing these headers. Okay, first, let's discuss how to find RFC 2616, which contains detailed descriptions of all HTTP response headers observed in today's marketplace. The quickest and easiest way to find section 14 of the RFC 2616 is by using Google or another search engine of your choosing and then searching on keywords HTTP response headers. Also, for your convenience, I've included a direct link to Section 14 RFC 2616 to save you some time. Please note that I'm not here to reinvent the wheel, and therefore most of the verbiage observed throughout this presentation is derived directly from the RFC and only modified slightly when I need to make a point, as it specifically relates to WebSphere application server environments. With that said, let's proceed to slide number 4, where I will begin to discuss common HTTP response headers. There are many response headers to discuss in today's presentation. The first one being the content length header, which indicates the size of the entity body in decimal number of octets. This header is used to notify the client of how much content expected to be sent by the server. In the example above, the server is notifying the client to expect 3,495 bytes of data in the entity body. Next, the content type header field indicates the media type of the entity body sent to the recipient. Again, used to notify the client of what type of content the server is sending. In the example above, the server is notifying the client that the entity body being sent back is media type text slash HTML. Lastly, on this slide is the connection header, which allows the sender, being the server, to specify options that are desired for the particular connection. In the example above, the server is sending a connection close header. Note, when this header is sent in a response back to the client, the connection on the server side is closed after the last byte of data has been sent by the server. Okay? So if you see the connection close header in a response, that's an indication to the client that once the server's done sending data, it's going to close the connection instead of keep it open via keep alive. Okay? So let's proceed to slide number 5 to review more HTTP response headers. First, the cache control header is used to specify directives that must be obeyed by all caching mechanisms along the request and response chain. The directives specify behavior intended to prevent caches from adversely interfering with the request or response. In the above example, the server is notifying all cache mechanisms along the response chain to not cache the response. Next, the date header represents the date and time at which the message was originated, having the same semantics as original date in RFC 822. The field value is an HTTP date as described in section 3.3.1 in RFC 2616. It must be sent in RFC 1123 8 date format. Please note the RFC URL links provided above for your convenience. So with that said, let's proceed to slide number 6. Okay, so on slide number 6, the first header we're going to discuss is the expires header, which gives the date and time after which the response is considered stale. In simple terms, how long is the response valid? At this time, I would like to point out a couple of quick facts as they relate to expires headers. First, if a response includes a cache control field with a max age directive via C-section 14.9.3 of RFC 2616, that directive overrides the expires field. Second, to mark a response as already expired, an origin server sends an expires date that is equal to the date header value. Third, to mark a response as never expires, the origin server sends an expires date approximately 1 year from the time the response is sent. And last but not least, the presence of an expires header field with a date value of sometime in the future on a response that otherwise would be by default non-cacheable indicates that the response is cacheable unless indicated otherwise by a cache control header field. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 7. The first one, another common response header being the location header, is very important to understand. The location header is used to redirect the recipient, being the client, to a location other than the requested URI for completion of the request. Okay? Location headers are always included with a status code which begins with numeric character number 3. For example, a 302 redirect response. Note, a 302 status code notifies the client that what they requested was found but located in a different place. The response in this case will always contain a location header, notifying the client of the new URL the client should request to fulfill the request. 302 responses are common when using rewrites or redirects in a web server or using send redirect in WebSphere to redirect from non-SSL to SSL or to redirect clients to a different page after the client logs into an application, etc. Next, the content encoding header is used as a modifier to the media type. When present, its value indicates what additional content codings have been applied to the entity body, and thus what decoding mechanisms must be applied in order to obtain the media type referenced by the content type header field. Content encoding is primarily used to allow a document to be compressed without losing the identity of its underlying media type. As the above example shows, the server is notifying the client that the content being sent back is compressed. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 8 to discuss more HTTP response headers. The set cookie header is included with a response to notify the client to store the cookie. The client should include the cookie in the cookie request header when making additional HTTP requests to the server. The above example shows a set cookie header containing the JSession ID cookie, which contains the client session ID and the clone ID of the WebSphere application server which created the session. Next, the server response header contains information about the software used by the origin server to handle the request. So as you can see in the above example, the WebSphere application server version, which generated the header, is version 6.0. Lastly on this slide is the last modified header, which indicates the date and time at which the origin server believes the variant was last modified. Typically, this header is included with a 304 status code response. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 9, where we will review a couple of additional HTTP response headers before discussing where HTTP response headers are logged. These are the last two headers that we'll talk about today. The transform encoding header field indicates what type of transformation has been applied to the message body in order to safely transfer it between the sender and the recipient. The above example shows a transfer encoding header set to chunked, which is an indication to the client to expect the content to be sent back in chunks. The last header in today's presentation is the www authenticate response header. The header field must be included in 401 unauthorized response messages. The field value consists of at least one challenge that indicates the authentication scheme and parameters applicable to the request URI. Note, a client that wishes to authenticate itself with a server, usually but not necessarily after receiving a 401 response, does so by including an authorization request header field with the request. The authorization field value consists of credentials containing the authentication information of the client for the realm of the resource being requested. So this concludes our discussion of common HTTP response headers. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 10 to discuss where these type of headers are logged, so you may find them in your own WebSphere application server environment. There are several important logs where HTTP response headers can be logged. The first such log is a packet trace, which can be enabled to capture TCP/IP packets on a network that contain the HTTP request and response headers sent back and forth between the client and a server. A common packet trace tool available on the internet is Wireshark and can be downloaded from www.wireshark.org. Again, that's www.wireshark.org. Now, unfortunately, due to customer confidentiality, I'm unable to provide a packet trace output in this presentation, but I do want to make a note. If you do collect the packet trace and you're looking at the packets, and the packet trace has been collected over non-SSL, if you right-click on the packet that you're interested in viewing and select Follow TCP Stream, that'll bring up an actual separate window that will show you the actual request headers, and then you'll also see the response headers. Okay, so that's one area where you can actually see the actual request headers that are sent by a client and the response headers that are being sent back to the client. Okay, if it's an SSL packet trace, if you are using Wireshark, You can also unencrypt those packets and do the same thing, but it does require that you use your existing web server or application server certificates, and Wireshark has documentation on how you can do that. So next, any outgoing HTTP response header field details can be logged in the IBM HTTP service access log. Now, in order to do that, you need to use the custom log format, and you need to add percent, bracket, the name of the header that you're trying to log, bracket, and then O. And O stands for outbound or outgoing headers, okay? As in a previous presentation I did, if you wanted to record incoming request headers, you would simply change the O to I. Now, the above example shows how to set the log format to log the contents of the content type response header sent by the server. Note, you can log the details of as many response headers as you like using the actual percent bracket header name bracket out syntax, okay, the O syntax. So with that said, let's proceed to slide number 11. Okay, so in addition to the web server's access log, so that we know that you can log response headers in packet traces, we know that you can log the value of response headers in your access log using the log format, okay? But you can also log this information in your plugin if you have your log levels set to trace in the plugin cfg.xml. HTTP response headers, which are passed by WebSphere back to the HTTP plugin, will be logged in the http://plugin.log. As the above example shows, we can see the plugin is receiving a 200 status code along with a content type, content language, set cookie, transfer encoding, date, server, expires, and cache control headers. All those headers were sent by WebSphere and are logged in the plugin's http://plugin.log. So last but not least, let's proceed to slide number 12, which shows an example of a WebSphere application server's trace.log where HTTP response headers can also be recorded. Okay, so in the previous slide, we discussed HTTP response headers sent by the WebSphere application server being logged in the plugin log. But in addition, if tracing is enabled on the WebSphere application server side, these same generated response headers can be logged on that side in the trace.log file as the above example shows. And I've also included in this presentation some recommended trace strings that we would want you to set in order to get that detailed level of tracing. So that pretty much wraps up today's presentation. So let's go ahead and proceed to the final slide, which is slide number 13. And again, this slide is just a reference for you for where you can actually find more information on HTTP response headers. It's a link to the RFC. All HTTP headers as well as status codes are logged in the RFC. These presentations were designed, and this one in particular, was designed to show you the ones that we see in WebSphere, because typically you won't see all available headers when looking at WebSphere environments. So I only paid attention or only focused on the actual common ones that we see. So please keep that in mind when you do look at the RFC. And anyhow, that does wrap up today's presentation. And I'd like to go ahead and turn the presentation back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Robert, for a great presentation. At this point, Heather, we would like to open the line for questions.
And we'll hear first from Patrick Edison with IBM.
Hi, I have a question regarding, you used the word variant with regard to location. What do you mean by variant as stated in the last modified description? It's on slide number 8 at the bottom of the slide.
The variant in this case is actually the actual object being requested, or the actual file, whatever it is being requested. It's referred to as a variant in the RFC.
Okay. So, like, if you're requesting a certain page, it'll give you the date that page was last modified.
That is correct.
So I suppose it may not be a page. It may be some kind of dynamic content as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, so that's why it's generically called a variant.
Correct.
Okay, good.
And our next question comes from Val Nampini with AT&T.
Hi, this is Balan Pini. I have a little variant question, but regarding HTTP headers. Some of the clients, they use HTTP client, and some of the clients, they use Oakland HTTP client. How the headers are different, because I had a problem. When I was using the IBM IHS with the older version 2042, I was able to work with the Oakland HTTP client. But when I upgraded IBM to 2047, the headers weren't able to make through from the Oakland client, HTTP client, to IHS. And we had to change a parameter on the IHS server called keep alive equal to off. Only then it started working. What I understood from my discussion and my analysis was that the way the headers work in the Oakland HTTP client is different from the HTTP Apache client. Can you please shed a light on this? Am I missing something here?
Well, you're talking about like an open source client?
Yes. There's an application on OneBox which communicates as a web service connecting to a web server on another application. The one which is a client is an Oakland client, and it's connecting to IBM IHS server 2047. Why should I modify the keep alive default setting?
Okay, well, keep alive does, if you disable keep alive, you're talking about disabling it on the web server, correct?
Correct.
Okay, when you disable keep alive on the web server, what that does is that simply forces the web server, when it responds or when it provides a response back to that client, to send a connection close header. And it forces the web server at that time to close the connection on that client. Typically, that is needed when an open source client does not know how to properly handle keep alive connections. Because there are some open source clients, for whatever reason, the way that they've been built, they're not able to recognize keep alive. So what happens is they send a request, right? They send a request. They open a connection to a web server. They send the request across. The web server responds with the response and keeps the connection open. That client doesn't come back and request anything within the keep alive timeout. So then the web server's keep alive fires, and the connection on the web server side is closed. Because the client doesn't understand properly how keep alive works, the client, when it does go to make another request, tries to use that same original connection, but it's already been closed on the web server side. And as a result of that, the request fails.
Sorry to interrupt, but when you say it is closed on the web server side, you mean to say it has closed prematurely, or do you mean to say the client did not understand the connection is closed?
The client doesn't understand the connection is closed.
Oh, okay, got you.
Okay, because what happens is, and this is all happening at the TCP layer as well as, you know, the client layer, but what happens is keep alive connections, you know, once a response is sent back to a client, you now have an idle connection, but the connection is still open. The web server left the connection open and is sitting there in a read waiting to see if that client comes back and requests something else. Why is keep alive so important? Because it helps with performance, right? Because the client, when they come back and issue new requests, they don't have to open a brand new connection.
Correct.
But there are some clients that don't know how to interpret the trigger of a keep alive fire. So, or keep alive timeout, I should say. So what happens is you have an idle connection, the client hasn't yet come back and requested anything, keep alive timeout has fired, which can be 15 seconds by default on the web server. The web server now closes its side of the connection, but from a client point of view, the client thinks the connection is still open.
Right.
So then it tries to send a request across a closed connection, and you end up getting a reset at the TCP level on the web server side.
Okay.
So to compensate for that, the recommendation is for those type of clients who don't properly handle keep alive, simply disable keep alive on the web server, and that will force that connection close header to go back with every response. So the client immediately sees that header and knows, okay, the connection's been closed.
Okay. So, to finally, the bottom line is that the one thing is that it didn't understand the connection is closed. You mean to say is it that the client is not able to interpret the header information sent by the server? Or?
Well, if the server sends back a connection closed header, then the client is able to understand that.
Okay.
But keep alive, there is no – with keep alive, you don't actually have a response header that's sent back saying, I closed the connection.
Okay, got you.
Right, because the response has already been sent. Now you just have an idle connection, but then keep alive fires, and now the web server closes the connection, but doesn't actually send a response, another response back to the client telling them that it closed it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And we'll hear next from Andrew Pierce with Unum.
Hi, thank you. On page 10 of the presentation, we specify the response header that we wanted to include with the percent and then the content type in the brackets there. Where is this defined?
Good question. This is actually defined in the web server's httpd.com file. And this is specifically, I should clarify this, this is specifically for the IBM HTTP server. So if you're running a different web server like SunOne or IIS, they have other means or other mechanisms for logging headers. I don't know exactly what those are. But in this presentation, I specifically focused on the IBM HTTP server. So this log format directive is already in your httpd.com by default, but you would have to add this additional parameter that's indicated in the presentation to actually log header information in that log. Does that answer your question?
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
And we have a question from Shraf Babu Krishna with Alto.
The server header, does it have the value of the final application server information, or is it the IHS server it will return to the client?
Okay, that's another good question. There's the server header will actually be the server that wrote the response back to the client. So, for example, let me give you a good example here. If you actually make a request for, let's say, login.jsp, right, that's obviously a dynamic request, and that's going to be serviced by WebSphere, right? But you're coming in through the web server, okay?
Yeah.
The client first makes the connection to the web server and sends that request across. The plugin in the web server then looks at that request and also makes a separate connection to the WebSphere application server and sends that same request across to WebSphere. The response from WebSphere back to the plugin will have a server header as WebSphere application server version, okay? Then when the response that the plugin received from WebSphere is now given back to the web server writes the response back to the client, and now the server header is changed to be IBM HTTP server. Because you actually have two client connections. You have the actual client, the original client, that makes the connection to the web server, and then you have the second client, which in this case is the plugin, because the plugin is a client, and it makes the request to the application server. So the response from WebSphere to plugin will have a server header of WebSphere application server, and the server header that's sent back to the client will have a server header of IBM HTTP server. It's always the actual server that has direct communication to the actual client is the server that will be identified in the server header. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So some of the other headers, like for example, the connection, is it just relayed whatever the app server sends? Is it relayed back to the client or?
No. Always think of it this way. Whenever you're dealing with client requests and you're going through a web server, in reality, you actually have two separate client requests taking place. You have the original client request to the web server, and then you have an actual second client request from the plugin to the application server. So the application server might return a response to plugin saying, close the connection. But because keep alive is enabled on the web server side, the response that goes back to the client in that case is still keep alive.
Thanks.
And it appears we have no further questions at this time.
At this time, we will conclude the presentation.